Truly, what was there to wish or to do when he had finished speaking? When he stopped, he looked round with a satisfied smile. He had secured himself strongly against attack, and stamped the threatened demand as monstrous, as an unloving offense against himself, which no one could think of inflicting upon him. He could not have dreamed that the woman before him paid no heed to this interpretation. Sitting crouched under her cloak, she had greedily sucked in the honey of his words. Her tense excitement had left no syllable escape of all that he said in Joseph's praise, which greatly diminished its intended effect. Yet, strange to say, Moot remained honorably true to the strict and reasonable dictates which had given rise to this visit to Potiphar. She sat up erect and said, "I will assume, my husband, that what you have said in favor of the slave is the uttermost that can be justly said. And it is not enough. It is untenable before Egypt's gods. All this that you have been so good as to tell me, of the wonderful combination of qualities in your servant, and of his mysterious charm, all that counts as nothing in face of Amun's just demand through my mouth. For I too am a mouthpiece, not alone he whom you say is indispensable to your house. Clearly without due reflection, for how can a chance stranger be indispensable in the land of men, and in Petipre's house, which was a house of blessing before this outlander began to wax strong within it? That should never have come to pass. If the lad was once bought, he should have been sent to labor in the fields, instead of keeping him in the courtyard, and even entrusting him with your cup, and lending your ear to his reading because of his insinuating gifts. The talents are not the man. One must make a distinction, for it is so much the worse when a base man has gifts which can make one finally forget his natural baseness. What are those gifts which can justify the elevation of the base? Montcalm, your steward, should have asked himself that, who, without your orders, as you say, made this lowly slave flourish like a weed in your house, to the shame of all the pious. Will you permit him, now that he is dying, to defy the gods, and point with his finger at the Shabarite as his successor, so shaming your house before the world, and humbling your own people beneath his foot, so that they gnash their teeth? My dear one, said the chamberlain, how you deceive yourself. You are not well informed, to judge from your words, for there is no thought of teeth gnashing. All the other servants love Osarsif, from high to low, from the scribe of the buffet to the kennel boys, and to the least of your handmaidens, and take no shame to do his will. I know not whence this report that folk gnash their teeth at his advancement, for it is quite false. On the contrary, they all seek his glance, and gladly vie to do each his best when he comes amongst them. They hang joyously upon his lips when he gives them orders. Yes, even those who had to step aside from their office to make way for him, even they do not look askance, but straight in his eye, for his gifts are irresistible. And why? Because he is not what you say. Nor are his gifts a lying appendage to his person, and to be distinguished from it. For they are mingled together and are one, the gifts of one blessed with the blessing, so that you might say he deserves them, if that again were not an untenable division between the person and his gifts, or if you can speak at all of merit in connection with natural gifts. But it has come about that on the landways and the waterways, folk recognize him from afar. They nudge each other and say, there is Osarsif, Petipre's body-servant and mouth to Montcalm, an excellent youth, going about the business of his lord, which he will perform to advantage, as is his way. Moreover, though men look him in the eye, it is said that women avoid it, but give him sidling glances, which is as good a sign. And when he shows himself in the streets of the city and in the bazaar, it often happens that the maidens mount on the housetops and fling down gold rings upon him from their fingers, that he may look up at them. But he never does. Annie listened in speechless ecstasy. This glorification of Joseph, the description of his popularity, intoxicated her beyond words. Bliss ran like fire through her veins, made her bosom rise and fall, and her breath come sobbingly in gasps. Her very ears grew red. Only with the greatest difficulty could she prevent her lips from curving in a beatific smile as she listened. A benevolent onlooker must have shaken his head at the deluded creature. This praise of Joseph must have confirmed her in her weakness, if we may so express it, for the foreign slave. It must have justified this weakness in the face of her own pride, plunged her still deeper in, made her still less capable of carrying out her purpose of saving her own life. Was that a ground for joy? No, not for joy, but for ecstasy, a distinction which the well-wishing friend, though shaking his head, is bound to make. She suffered, too, that goes without saying. What Petitpré said about the women, how they looked, how they cast down their rings, that confirmed her again in her weakness, and filled her at the same time with scorching jealousy, and with hatred for those whose feelings were her own. It consoled her a little to hear that Joseph did not look at them, and it helped her to persevere in her project of behaving like a reasonable being. She said, "I will pass over, my friend, your lack of delicacy in entertaining me with the ill behavior of the women of Wesey, be there much or little truth in such reports, for they may have their source in the conceited youth himself, or in such as he has bribed with promises." It cost her less than one would think to speak thus of the object of her already hopeless love. She did it mechanically, making herself speak like another than herself. Her musical voice took on a hollow tone, corresponding to the fixity of her features and the vacancy of her gaze. The whole made up a picture of deliberate guile. It is more important to point out that when you say, "I am falsely informed as to the situation in the house," your charge is unfounded and falls to the ground. It would be much better if you had not made it. Your habit of taking nothing upon yourself, but of seeing all with distant and detached eye, should make you doubt whether you are yourself so well informed. The truth is that the forwardness of this youth has become a subject for violent anger and widespread disaffection in the house. Dudu, the guardian of your jewel caskets, has more than once, yes, very often, taken occasion to speak before me, uttering bitter complaints of the offense to the pious in making them suffer the domination of impure stock. Petitpré laughed. "You have found a wonderful witness, my blossom. Take it not ill of me that I say so. Dudu is a pompous, puffed-up toad, a quarter-size man, and made to be laughed at. How in the world could he be taken seriously in this or any other matter?" "The size of his person," she retorted, "is not to the purpose. But if his view is so contemptible, his judgment so worthless, how then is it that he was chosen guardian of your wardrobe?"
"It was a joke," said Petitpré.
"Only in jest could one give such a man an office. The other clown, his little mate, they even call vizier. But certainly they are not serious when they do it." "I need not call your attention to the difference between them," she answered. "You know it well enough, though at this moment you would deny it. But it is sad that I must defend your most loyal and worthy servant against your ingratitude. Aside from his small stature, Dudu is a serious and dignified man, who in no way deserves the name of clown, and whose judgment is valuable in affairs of the house and of his own honor."
"He reaches up to here on me," remarked the captain of the guard, making a line on his shin with the edge of his hand.
Moot was silent for a while. "You know, my husband," she said then, with self-control, "that you are uncommon in height and strength, so that Dudu's size must seem smaller to you than to most other men, or, for instance, to Jesset, his wife, my woman, and to his children, who are of ordinary size, and look up to their father with loving respect."
"They look up?"
"I use the word advisedly, in a higher poetic sense."
"So you express yourself even poetically about your Dudu," Petitpré mocked her. "Since you have complained of my bad taste in choice of subjects, I may remind you that you have dwelt overlong upon this conceited fool."
"We may well leave the subject," she said compliantly, "if it displeases you. I do not need his evidence or support in the matter of our discussion, since the request I would make
is thrice justified of itself. His evidence is not needed to prove that you must grant it. You have a request? He asked.
So then, he said to himself rather bitterly, it is true that she came with some purpose of a more or less troublesome nature. My hope is vain that her visit was simply for the sake of my presence. It cannot make me well disposed toward her request. He asked,
And what request?
This, my husband, that you should send away the foreign slave, whose name I will not again speak, from your house and courtyard, where he has sprung up like a weed, by dint of culpable negligence and lying favor, so that he has made it a house of offense instead of an example to the lands.
O Sarsif, from house and courtyard? What are you thinking of?
I think, my husband, of right and justice. I think of the honor of your house, of the gods of Egypt, and what you owe to them. Not alone to them, but to yourself and me, your sister wife, who shakes the sistrum before Amun in the adornment of the mother, consecrate and set apart. I think of these things, and am certain beyond any doubt that I need only remind you of them for your thoughts to unite with mine, and for you to grant my request without delay.
By sending Osarsif? My dear, it may not be. Put it out of your mind. It is in vain. It is a whim which I cannot entertain, for it is a stranger to my mind, and all my thoughts rise up against it.
So there we have it, he said to himself, in anger and bewilderment. That is the request, and that is why she came to me at this hour, and seemed to come that we might talk together. I saw it coming, yet on my side would not see it, so offensive it is to my justified self-interest. I would have granted something small, wishing to seem great to her, but unhappily this that she thinks small and simple to grant is for me inconvenient in the extreme. Not without justification did I feel the approach of a disturbance to my peace. Yet what a pity that she has offered me no occasion to rejoice her heart, for I am reluctant to hate her. Your prejudice, my little flower, said he, against the person of this youth, so great as to make you launch so foolish a request, is very sad. Clearly you know nothing of him save for the complaints and curses of misshapen and misbegotten persons, and have no direct knowledge of his excellent gifts, which, young as he is, could, in my opinion, exalt him much higher than even the stewardship of my house. You call him barbarian and slave, and literally you are right. But is that right enough, if it denies the spirit? Is it the custom and way of our land to esteem a man accordingly as he is free or unfree, native or foreign, and not rather according to his spirit, whether it is dark and undisciplined, or enlightened through the word and ennobled by the magic of its eloquence? What is our practice in Egypt? For the youth has a blithe and lucid manner of speech, with well-chosen words and charming intonation, writes a decorative hand, and reads aloud from my books as though he spoke himself by the motion of his own spirit, so that all their wit and wisdom seem to come from him and belong to him, and one can only wonder. I could wish you to take notice of his parts, to talk graciously with him and win his friendship, which would be much more pleasing to you than that of yon arrogant toad. I will neither take notice of him nor have speech with him, she said frigidly. I see that I was mistaken when I thought you had exhausted your praise. You had still something to add. But now I await your word and the granting of my well-justified, my pious request. No such word, he replied, can I utter in response to a request so signally mistaken. It cannot be granted, and for more than one reason. The only question is whether I can make this clear to you. If not, alas, it will not be the more easily granted. I have told you that Osarsif is not an ordinary slave. He brings increase to our house. He serves it incredibly. Who could bring himself to send such a person away? It would be to rob the household,
and to him gross injustice, for he is free from error and a youth of the finest fiber, so that it would be a rarely unpleasant business simply to send him away without cause, and no one would be prepared to do it. You fear the slave. I fear the gods who are with him, who make everything that is put in his hand succeed, and give him charm in the eyes of all the world. What gods they are is beyond my judgment, but they show themselves powerful in him beyond a doubt. You would quickly forget such ideas, for instance, of burying him in field labor, or selling him, if you would once forget your refusal to know him better. Very soon, I assure you, your heart would feel sympathy and softening toward the youth, for there is more than one point of contact between your life and his. And if I love to have him about me, believe me that it is because often he reminds me of you. Petipre, I say what I say, and what I think is by no means meaningless. Are you not dedicate and set apart for the god before whom you dance as his bride? And do you not wear your sacrificial adornments before men? Well then, I have it from the youth himself that he too wears such an adornment, invisible like your own. One must imagine a sort of evergreen, which is a symbol of consecrated youth, and bears the significant name of Touch Me Not. All this he has told me, and I listened not without amazement, for he spoke of strange things. I knew of the gods of Asia, Attis and Ashrat, and the Baals of the growth, but he and his live under a god strange to me, and of amazing jealousy, for this unique god is solitary, and feels a great need of loyalty, and he has betrothed himself to them as a bridegroom. It is all strange enough. In principle, they each wear the evergreen, and are set apart to their god like a bride, but one among them he chooses as a whole sacrifice, and that one must wear it with a difference, and as one specially dedicate to the jealous god. And such a one is Osarsif. They know a thing, he says, which is called sin, and the garden of sin, and have imagined beasts which leer from among the branches in the garden, ugly beyond conception. There are three of these, and they are called shame, guilt, and mocking laughter. But now I will ask you two questions. First, can one have a better servant and steward than one born to loyalty and fearing sin in his very bones? And second, was it too much to say when I spoke of a point of contact between you and this youth? Ah, how Mut's heart contracted at her husband's words. Agony had consumed it when he spoke of the maidens who threw down their rings, but that had been nothing compared with the icy sword which pierced it when she understood why the daughters of Waysay had not succeeded in drawing his gaze upon them. A frightful anguish, a presentiment of all she was to bear, came over her, and painted itself openly on the pale, agonized face turned up to Petipre. If we try to put ourselves in her place, we shall see that the situation did not lack an element of absurdity. For why was she struggling and wrestling with her husband's obstinacy if he was speaking the truth? If the healing and revealing dream which had brought her hither was but a lying dream, if he from whom she would save her own life and her husband's was a whole sacrifice, already promised, devoted, and set apart. What an involvement was this, in which she had feared to involve herself. She had not strength. She dared not attempt to cover her eyes with her hand. They stared into space, where she seemed to see the three beasts in the garden, shame, guilt, and mocking laughter, of whom the last whined like a hyena. It was unbearable. She was overwhelmed. Only away with him, more than ever now, since those healing dreams had been all a lie. Thrice shameless dreams, since it would be quite vain were she even to throw down to him the rings from her fingers. Yes, I must fight, she thought, more than ever now, if this be true. But do I believe it?
or do I not rather cherish a secret hope that my dreams will prove stronger than his bond, will overpower it, so that he will return my gaze and still my blood? Do I not hope and fear with a force which in my soul I believe to be irresistible? And seeing that clearly once for all, must he not away, out of my sight, out of this house, that my life may be saved? There sits my fat-armed husband, like a tower of strength. Dudu, who can beget children, reaches up to his shin. He commands the troops. From him and his cherishing have I to hope healing and saving. From his alone.